Hey everyone, this is John.
This is Wes.
And this is Ryan.
And this is the Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. This is the Nintendo Show 64, as we often call it when we do a retro-focused show like this. And we're going to do another show like we did last month, which I think turned out really well, where we just kind of like go through the entire month of where we are in 1999. We go 21 years back, so June of 1999, and just talk about, like, we'll focus a lot on video games, then we'll also talk about some other pop culture type stuff, some comics and some movies, possibly some music, as well as some sports. Just kind of like give a snapshot of what June 1999 was like. And guys, what a time to be alive.
Oh my god.
Oh yeah.
So I actually did like think about it earlier today when I was taking the dog for a walk. In June of 1999, I was 14. I had graduated middle school and I was going into high school. Wes, we established last month that you were 10 years old in 1999.
Did we?
Yeah, we did, because you were telling a story about something that happened. Wait, is that not the case?
I don't know. I can't.
Okay, if you say so.
Sure, I was 10. Sure, why not? We'll go with that.
Yeah.
That sounds legit.
Yeah, you told us that story about how your uncle tickled you too much, and then you started peeing the bed again.
I told you that one in confidence, not on air.
I don't even think I was here for that conversation, so I need to hear the story again. And then, Ryan, did we graduate high school the same year, 2003?
I'm 2002.
Oh, okay.
So I'm 2007.
I would have been a freshman in high school, I guess. I think if that's right. Wait, you said you were in 8th grade?
Yeah, I just finished 8th grade, and was like in the fall I would have been starting high school.
Oh yeah, same deal here then. That means I would have been just done with my first year of high school.
Mm-hmm. But now we are entering the the summer month, you know, seasonally speaking, like in sort of like American culture. Of course, summer doesn't start until June 20th in 2020 anyway, but neither here nor there, because we do have we're going to start with a game, and this game we didn't talk about last month, mostly because I didn't realize that it was coming out, but this one just reaching back a day before into May of 1999, and that was when Command & Conquer was ported over to the N64. And Command & Conquer is, of course, a PC game. Came out in 1993 originally, and then the Gold Edition, which is the game that I played a ton of back in the day, came out for Windows 95, if you kids remember that one.
Oh, my God.
This game was developed by Westwood Studios, rest in peace, and Nintendo actually published it on the N64, although after watching some brief videos, I think EA might have also been involved. At this point in 1999, EA had bought Westwood Studios, which led to its impending destruction.
Oh, but, thanks again, EA. God.
Yeah, they ruin everyone's fun. But Command & Conquer is such a fun RTS. I do have a cartridge on the way. It did not get here in time for recording of the show, though. But this one was kind of... It was definitely the first RTS that I played, and it did a lot to popularize the genre, and in like the wake of the Command & Conquer series, you get other really popular series such as Age of Empires and StarCraft, which comes out in 1998. But Command & Conquer, you have two campaigns at the start. You have the Global Defense Initiative and the Brotherhood of Nod, and they are both fighting to, I don't even know what the impetus is. Like, Nod is trying to like conquer the planet, and GDI is kind of like the UN fighting against them. But they both have very different units and structures, especially for such an early RTS. They are not just clones of each other. In fact, I think they only have one or two units that are shared between the two different factions. And then StarCraft is a game that really raises the bar in this when it comes out in 98 with three very different factions that, you know, even like building bases and deploying units and doing things like research works very differently from faction to faction. But Command & Conquer was really the standard bearer for the genre throughout most of the mid-90s. So in the game, of course, you have infantry and tank units as well as some limited aircraft. Nothing as far as like naval units or anything like that. We weren't at that point with RTSs quite yet. But the two factions play differently, where you have like one, the sort of the bad guys, Nod. They have to use speed and cunning more, whereas the good guys, the GDI, are able to just use overwhelming force with massive tanks and stuff that could just roll over enemies. You have different defensive and strategic structures with guardhouses and turrets, and the Nod faction can deploy a nuclear bomb. The GDI faction eventually gets an ion cannon that just kind of zaps a laser, like any sort of building or structure, with a laser beam to take it out. You have some resource management. Unlike other RTS games, especially things like Age of Empires and StarCraft, you only have one sort of resource to manage, and that's your Tiberium, which is the green glowy gems that grow around the battlefield. You send out your little harvester unit to gather it up. It brings it back to your refinery, and it turns it into cash. And the thing about this particular resource is it does slowly regrow. So unlike something like a StarCraft or an Age of Empires, when you don't really have a source that runs out. It does, of course, grow very slowly, so it does give you that incentive to, you know, move things along and not take forever in a fight. But if you are having a hard time, you can just kind of really slowly build up resources and take your time with it if you need that extra time. Oftentimes, a lot of the fights, one of the initial early strategies is to find where the enemy is gathering their Tiberium, their resource, and take out their harvester units to slow down their own production of units. So there's a lot that you can to think about when like deploying units on a battlefield and where you're sending them and what you're attacking and that sort of stuff. So of course it doesn't have all the features such as like all your different tanks and units from the start. It builds up from mission to mission, and it does have some interesting mission structures. It's not purely just build up an overwhelming attack force and mow down an enemy base. Sometimes you don't even get buildings, especially in the Nod missions. There are a lot of missions where it's just like you get this strike force of units and you have to go and accomplish the mission with what you have. A lot of the GDI missions in the beginning or in the middle of the game, you have to take over a rundown base and maintain it, and you don't have access to a lot of different things such as just basic structures for building tanks. So you have to make sure that your tanks are maintained and repaired and maintain your defenses until you're ready to actually mount a strike. You have to be very careful because you're not able to rebuild everything that you lose. One of the things about the game is that enemies do attack in very predictable waves. At the beginning of a mission, it's usually something that you're barely able to maintain or repel, but then as you gather more resources and build up your defenses, it becomes more manageable. Then you can start sending out your own strike force. So It is an early RTS, so a lot of missions can just be overcome by building up large forces of tanks and just rushing an enemy base, but there are a couple of different strategies you can use, such as building up engineer infantry characters, which take over enemy buildings, which can be really fun to sneak them into an enemy base and take over their means of production and start just building up enemy units to destroy them from inside their own base. You can just build sandbag walls and kind of creep up to their base and build your own defensive structures right outside there, so they're never actually able to leave their base. Because in this game, and they change this as the series goes on, there's a sort of grid, invisible grid around your base, how far out you can build structures. Kind of the pylons for the Protoss, where you only have a specific arena in which you can build your own structures. But if you just build a wall, which you can leave that arena, up to the enemy base, you can then build structures kind of branching off of that wall. And that's something that they get rid of in future games because you can just kind of break the game that way. But, aside from your main objectives, which is usually just kill all the enemies on the field, there are some objectives that are not broadcasted. So there are a few missions where, you're playing as the GDI, the good guys, and if you destroy all of the enemy surface-to-air missile sites, you can start just calling in airstrikes. So a few planes will, fly over their base and drop napalm bombs on them, which is a really fun little side thing that you can do. So the N64 version does not have the human actor full motion videos that the PC version had. They weren't able to, that would be very impressive if they were able to compress that onto a cartridge. It does have MIDI-based music and also no winter terrain. Everything's just the standard brown or green terrain. There's no online multiplayer for obvious reasons. And there were some units that were removed, and most of the units that were removed were exclusive to the online play, so it's pretty obvious why they had to be removed, but there was a surface-to-surface missile launcher, a chemical warfare infantry unit, as well as an Apache helicopter, and these were all units that the Nod faction, the bad guys, would be using, but they were locked into the multiplayer, so you didn't actually get to use them in the campaign. But you can get this cart on N64 for a few bucks. I did watch some videos of it, and it looks fine for an N64 game. I think it's probably... I should correct that. They were definitely using an emulator, because I could see their PC desktop behind the video window. So they could have been up-resing it there as well. So I don't want to draw too many conclusions about the visuals before I actually get the cart in an actual N64.
I think it looks amazing.
Are you sure you're not looking at video for the remaster? Because the remaster did just come out on Steam.
No, I'm not watching any video or anything. I'm just giving you a hard time.
And the actual remaster.
Oh no, this is Red Alert 2. Never mind.
So it should look significantly better. But the remaster that just came out on Steam is actually coming to Switch at some point. So you can once again play a game intended for PC on a console, which it has to be clumsy, especially with that N64 analog stick.
Oh my gosh,
honestly, like a lot of these ones that I've gone back and looked at, most people generally say that the control setup isn't... They love this expression I hear where it's like, the controls aren't as bad as you'd think. Which is sort of a backhanded compliment in a way, where it's sort of like, you would assume that it's totally not playable, but it turns out it's not so bad.
Okay.
And honestly, like, and I know this is so many incarnations down the line from a game that came out in, what, like, 91? Mm-hmm. But I've been playing Civ 6 on Switch.
Oh, nice.
And it's kind of like, again, it's not like you have your joystick is now a mouse or anything. They totally rebuild the menu system to make it palatable for a player. So
yeah,
they would have done something similar.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering about with this Command & Conquer game on N64 is you have like a simple drop-down menu or sidebar menu where you get to select like the units and the structures that you want to build. I'm wondering if they remap those to some buttons rather than having to drag like a cursor over to a sidebar. One of the things about the PC version that was so great is like a lot of RTS games have this. You can just kind of hotkey different squads. You can build like squads and set them to just different keys, and so you can flip between them real quick just by pressing the button. And that's probably not something they're going to be able to achieve on an N64 remake. So the videos I was watching the first couple of missions, and the guy playing wasn't actually, because the maps are so small in the beginning and there's so few enemies, the guy wasn't even bothering building a base. He was just taking his units that he had and using the vehicles to just run over the enemy infantry. So it makes me wonder if it's just easier to squish the enemy rather than actually trying to engage in the building systems. We'll see.
Yeah.
So, on June the 1st, 1999, Napster launched
and changed
music distribution forever with peer-to-peer file sharing.
Yep.
Did you guys use Napster?
No, that's too young. I had no idea.
Oh, yeah, I did. I used Napster. Yeah. I think at the time was another one called BearShare and LimeWire. I was all about trading illegal content like that.
What I used in high school was like Shark something. I forget what that one was called.
Sure wasn't BearShare?
I don't think so. It was like Shark something.
SoundShark, maybe?
Maybe SoundShark. That sounds familiar.
That sounds familiar for some reason.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
But yeah, man, I used to love this stuff back in the day. Like, and I remember that, if I'm remembering it was right, it was on Napster, you actually had a queue. So if you wanted to download an album from somebody, it would kind of get stacked in your queue, and you had your own queue of people wanting to get your music. And from there, you could kind of control the list of people you're uploading to. So if for some reason somebody goes onto your thing and it's just like, I'm getting 20 of your albums, you could immediately just delete every single one of them from the queue and be like, don't be, and then message them directly and be like, don't be a greedy asshole, take one album at a time. And vice versa, like, you know, you could then reorganize the queue as well. So you could move up if someone you liked wanted a record, someone you personally knew, you could move that to the top. And I would do the same for others, like I would just download stuff. And yeah, I mean, I loved it. I thought it was cool.
That is interesting. I never heard of that, because like that makes it like there's a sort of like decorum or etiquette to what you're doing as you're stealing music.
Oh, absolutely. And it would also be annoying because it's not like now where pretty much everybody can be expected to have a constant stream of online access, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people were still on dial-up at the time, right? So you would oftentimes find yourself downloading an album and get like 7 of the 12 tracks downloaded, and then they went offline to never return. So then you're now trying to download the same album from another source who's got a different bit rate and different tags on the MP3s. Like, oh my god, just thinking about this out loud is like making my skin crawl. I hate it. Like, I'm so glad that things like Spotify, and now my obsession is vinyl records, so. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that if I want digital music, I've got Spotify, which is this giant library for me, and then if I want to have a tangible source, I've got my vinyl records.
Yeah, but this Napster thing, it was incredibly disruptive to the music industry in general. Like, record companies were upset, musicians were upset, because, you know, they were not riding as powerful a gravy train anymore. But yeah, this is, it changed the way, like, they eventually had to adapt to how they were, you know, distributing music themselves, because, like, they no matter what they did, there was no going back from this. Like, this was now...
Yeah.
Digital distribution becomes like the primary way that people are consuming music now.
And it took time for that to occur. And again, yeah, it was with the industry fighting it heavily. Think about like how the automotive industry has always fought, you know, like what would you say, like fuel economy, right? Like, you know, trying to get laws passed to regulate a certain degree of fuel economy is just like fighting tooth and nail. Same with them. And again, because if you think back to like at that time, that was when your CD, like just one single compact disc of an album that you probably didn't even get a chance to hear unless it was on the radio or unless somebody like had a copy to loan you or something. You're going in blind on a lot of the albums you're purchasing, and they're between $15 and $20.
Hmm.
You know, CDs were expensive back in the day. And then on top of that too, like look at CD production has decreased dramatically for music, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like nowadays, virtually, like I'm sure they're still making CDs, but nobody really buys them anymore.
Yeah, I saw them at Target. We have a small little section from our movies,
and they're probably less than $10 a piece, right?
$13.99
for like a brand new title.
Yeah,
you know, it's like the cost was so clearly low. Like they were spending maybe a dollar a unit on their production costs, right? So all of this money was basically going to studios, and a little bit of that pie was going to the artists themselves. Like, total ripoff of the consumer. Like, they were kind of just created this artificial scarcity, charged you out the ass for it, and then from there, now you've got to, like, carry... And I remember, God, because I worked at a music store for so long, seeing how easy it was to devalue a CD is pretty impressive. Like, you know, like, literally just take... Like, people would have those books. They'd have, like binders of CDs, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it would always be this big thing where someone's like, oh, I got this whole thing full of CDs. And it's like, well, where are the inserts? You know, if they didn't keep the inserts, there's no value to the CD anymore.
Mm.
You can't... Nobody... Like, you couldn't take it to the store I worked at and sell somebody a big book of vinyl... Or, sorry, like a big book of CDs without the artwork. The front and back inserts, right?
Yeah.
So, if you get rid of those, you have a coaster. Unless you care about the contents on the CD, you have a coaster. Good
like
for
that,
you.
Yeah, that was one thing. Because like when you got to think about if you're trading in, like taking a used CD, then you have to turn around and sell it. And if you have like a CD with, you know, still got the original jewel case with the artwork and the inserts, people are much more likely to actually buy that used than if it's just a CD in a generic jewel case. Even though, as soon as they get home, they're going to take it out of that generic jewel case and put it in a bind of their own. You know, there is something to having that artwork where you feel like... You're actually buying something of higher value.
Oh, that in and of itself kills me. Like, I love having vinyl records, you know, because you have a big immediate piece of art in front of your face. And then versus a CD, which is just like the small little compact thing, and it's you don't get all the artwork. I mean, sure, you get like a little insert, and you know, hopefully they've got pages of information in there, but it's just not really the same.
Oh, yeah, back in the day, like every page would be like the words to each of the songs and everything. You used to have all that on them and everything.
But... I mean, vinyl records do the same thing. Most records I buy have an insert that's got all of the lyrics on one giant sheet of paper for you to there, and you don't have to like flip through a book to get them. Oh, and also just like how easy it is to destroy the contents of. I have so much information about CDs from working at a fucking music store for so long, but like literally take your book of CDs to the beach, get a little bit of sand in the case, and watch every, like, you could literally then take the CD, hold it up to a light source, and see light coming through where grits of sand had eaten through. And that's just completely lost information. That CD is going, should go straight into the trash can. Like, you just, people would buy $1,000 worth of CDs and then ruin them all in one beach trip.
Hmm.
It's sad, but hey, so it goes.
So, on June 8th, we got a Game Boy Color game.
Woo!
Conker's Pocket
Tales. No, it's Command. It's Command and Conker's Pocket Tales, right?
there's a Game Boy Color game, but also compatible with the original Game Boy. I actually just listened to an episode of Retronauts where they talked about the Game Boy Color, and something that I wasn't aware of, and maybe we should have talked about the Game Boy Color more in detail when it actually came out chronologically, but it actually had a little bit more RAM than a Game Boy. So, you know, you could make games that were exclusive to Game Boy Color that wouldn't run on the original Game Boy. There weren't a whole lot of them. I think the highest profile ones were probably like the Oracle games that came out on the Game Boy Color, I believe in 2000 or 2001. But it wasn't like a totally new piece of hardware, but it was like a quarter step above the Game Boy, because it did have a little bit more RAM that you could work with to develop these games. But Conker's Pocket Tales was developed and published by Rare. And the N64 follow-up to this game is probably more well-known. It's called Conker's Bad Fur Day, and we'll get to this one. But it's mostly known as a violent, crass game that stars a cute little squirrel mascot. But this Game Boy Color game, it was intended more to be like this cutesy, like, kids game with a squirrel mascot character. And for whatever reason, when they made the N64 game, they took it in a totally different direction tonally. So, this Game Boy Color game, it's a top-down adventure game with sort of like Zelda-style, like, block push puzzles and like mini puzzles and stuff. You get area maps similar to a Zelda. You have different sections of the map. Each of them has 8 presents you can find. You don't need to find all these little MacGuffins to progress to the next area, but if you're into collecting things, you can find them all. And you just find him like through exploration and light puzzle solving. Like, he's got a couple of different abilities. He'll get a slingshot that he can shoot things down with. There are talking acorns that will kind of point you in the direction you want to go. And there are patches of the ground where the squirrel dude Conker can burrow down and reemerge in another patch of soft ground somewhere. And I'm pretty sure it's like preset locations. If you dig here, you're going to reemerge here. But, yeah.
Question, why are the acorns helping you if you're a squirrel?
I don't know. I wondered that too.
Yeah, that's odd.
I wonder if at the game it takes like a turn and the acorns were setting you up the whole time for failure.
That could be the case.
They were like luring you into a trap.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's not a great looking game. The colors are a bit washed out. There are points in the game, like, you're a little, like, brown character, and you're having to run through, like, these houses with brown wooden flooring. So, like, I can imagine if you're playing on a dark Game Boy screen, or Game Boy Color screen, and you're, like, in a car or something, like, it probably wouldn't lend itself to much portability. You probably need to be next to a light, or have, like, a little, like, those little worm light things. But it is running on very old tech, so... you know, the Oracle games that I mentioned before, those still look pretty good on a Game Boy screen, but, you know, it's still, you give it a little bit of leeway because it is such an old, it's running on such old hardware. This game is not available on any download service that I'm aware of. You can get a cart on Amazon for like $10 if you really want to. I watched like 20 or 30 minutes of it. I think you can pass.
Yeah, I'm watching 5 minutes of it, and I definitely would say you can pass. This is weird. This is really weird.
So, I have one baseball story for the month of June.
And you brought this up last podcast. I don't know if you were recording when you brought it up.
We recorded the tease, and then I gave you guys a little bit of a breakdown off air.
So I watched a video on it, and it is glorious.
It is amazing.
This is like, so good. Tell the story, because I would butcher it.
Okay, so buckle in. This is going to take a minute. So on June 9th, 1999, Bobby Valentine manager of the New York Mets, was ejected from a game in the 12th inning, but then returned to the dugout in disguise to continue to manage the game. That's what we're going to get into here. That's what we're breaking down.
Yeah.
So the game was Mets versus Blue Jays. As I mentioned before, Valentine was managing for the Mets. And just a little bit of a backstory, before this game, the Mets were on a 7-game skid. They had lost back-to-back games to the Yankees in the Bronx, so that's not something you want to do when you know you're the Mets. And after those two losses, the general manager for the Mets fires 3 of Valentine's coaches, like Valentine's guys, people that he'd worked before and many times and liked. And this was, you know, there's some speculation that this is possibly in an attempt to just get Valentine to quit. I don't know, like, what the politics of that is. Why wouldn't you just fire Bobby Valentine rather than trying to get him to quit by firing his coaches? I don't know. That seems a little suspect.
I can put a button on this when we get to what becomes of Bobby Valentine with the Mets.
Okay.
But go on.
But Bobby Valentine doesn't take the bait, if that's what they're baiting him to do, and he stays on to coach with new coaches picked by the GM, not his guys. So he does turn the season around. The Mets in 1999 end the season with a record of 97-68, and they lose to the Braves in the NLCS. So good season, even though they had that 7-game losing streak. So going into the ninth, the Mets were ahead. The Blue Jays tied up 3-3 in the bottom of the ninth, so it goes to extra innings. In the 12th, Toronto is batting. There is a runner on first. So the pitcher is trying to pitch out to the catcher and attempt to pick off the runner who's going from first to second. So they know the runner is going to try to steal. So a pitch out, it's basically like you're throwing an intentional walk, but the intention is to give it to the catcher so the catcher can quickly fire to second and get the guy. But what the catcher in this case was Mike Piazza. So he gets the out at second, but things take a left turn because the home plate umpire makes a rare call, and the call was a catcher's balk. So what Piazza ends up doing is when the pitcher throws the pitch to him, he gets up, charges the pitch, and ends up stepping into the base path, catches the ball and fires it to second, gets the out, but then things get rewound a bit. So, a catcher's balk is not an official rule. It's more of a colloquial term. It's baseball vernacular. So, it's called when a catcher is not completely in the catcher's box, his little zone that he has to be in. It's called when he's not in that zone when the pitcher delivers the ball for an intentional walk for that express purpose. The balk statistic is still charged to the pitcher, but who gives a fuck about that? It's not going to cost him any money when it's time to go to free agency or renegotiate a contract. No one's looking at how many balks you had on the year. So Piazza, the catcher in this case for the Mets, charges the ball, steps out of the base path between home and first, which you can't do. You can't do that primarily for safety reasons, because sometimes even if you're pitching out or throwing a pitch for an intentional walk, the batter will still try to swing at it. So, you want to keep the catcher safe so he doesn't get hit with a bat. So, the home plate umpire calls this catcher's balk, awards first base to the batter, and the runner is safe at second. So, Valentine comes out to argue. Piazza is irate. Later on, Valentine will say to Piazza, will say that Piazza was trying to get tossed. He wanted to get thrown out of the game, but Valentine says that calms him down by letting him know, like, hey, we already pinched hit the other catcher. There are no more catchers. It's just you. So Valentine takes over with the arguing. And according to Valentine, he says to the ump, hey, can I get thrown out for what I'm thinking? And the ump says, no, you can't. So Valentine says what he's thinking and then gets tossed. So what
did
you
say he was thinking?
Never found out. Could not find that information. But it was something, big enough to where it gets him thrown out of the game in the 10th. So what you have to do when you're the manager is you have to turn over your lineup card to the next guy in command, the guy who's going to take over managing the game, so they know who's been used, who's available in the bullpen. So that's what Valentine does. He's back down in the clubhouse, Robin Ventura, whose name you might recognize from baseball, I believe he goes on to coach the White Sox for a bit, shows up there. I guess he was working with the Mets at the time, and tells him, like, hey, the coaches who, you know, just got hired on, they don't understand your lineup card because Bobby Valentine's a crazy old man. So Robin Ventura is telling him, you got to get back up there and manage this game. And Valentine is like, well, if I go back up and manage that game, I'm going to get kicked out of baseball. So with Valentine, a lot of this is told first person from Bobby Valentine, so take that for what it's worth. Valentine is telling him, like, I don't want to get kicked out. So Valentine says that Ventura told him, put on this hat and this sunglasses and get out there. And he says, put on this sunglasses for a night game. Like, it's already dark out, so it's conspicuous as it is. So Valentine puts those on. He takes off his baseball uniform shirt and puts on a t-shirt. And then he goes into the trainer room on his way up, and he sees those eyeline sticker thingies that you put underneath your eyes to help you with sun glare. And he takes two of those, sticks them on underneath his nose to look like a mustache. Now, when we were talking about this before, I was wondering, like, who the fuck just had a fake mustache sitting in their locker room? And it turns out it wasn't even a fake mustache. It was just those things for sun glare.
I mean, so based on the old video that I watched of it, it looks like a glorious mustache from the out of res brief shot.
Yeah.
From '99. Yeah. It looked glorious.
it wasn't a bad fake.
Yeah, so he looks a little bit like, because I've been watching a lot of old wrestling, he looks a lot like an old wrestler who was a heel named Ravishing Rick Rude.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah, who has that same big, thick mustache.
So he returns to the dugout in the game. He's wearing the hat, he's wearing the sunglasses, he's got the fake mustache and the t-shirt. The TV announcers spot him, and they're, like, giggling at him, like, that's clearly Bobby Valentine. He came back up to manage the game. And he sticks around till the end of the game. The Mets eventually win in the 14th. But the next day, Major League Baseball only finds out because it's a story in sports media. They did not notice him at all during the game, so he just stuck around. And he eventually, like, gets fined $5,000 and suspended for 3 games.
It could be that they might have known he was there and was just like, it's not worth it. It's not worth getting the security involved to remove this man from the baseball field. Like, you know, and hey, maybe because, like you're saying, it's sort of an unofficial rule. It's an umpire's discretion to make a call like that. Maybe the umpire was like, you know, hey, I'm not putting my career on the table here over this. If this guy wants to stick around and just sit in the dugout and not make a fuss, go ahead, stay. It's path of least resistance, right?
They're like gathering like amongst themselves, like, hey, that's clearly him. What do we do? Like, and none of them wants to get confrontational about it. Like, I don't know. Like, I'm not like going over there and telling him to leave again. We already had that conversation. I don't want to make a spectacle out of this. They're in the 14th inning. Like, they just want this game to be over.
Look at that mustache. Gets, like, I think he deserves to stay.
it's silly and it's harmless. Like, this is fine. And it's okay. So you charge the guy $5,000 and you make him sit out of 3 games. Yeah. And you don't let him wear a fake mustache for those 3. You know.
But you're asking, mustache.
Yeah. You're asking about what happened to Bobby Valentine, right? So I just finished listening to the Moneyball audiobook, which is about the 2002 Oakland Athletics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just great. I mean, it was not a read. It was a great listen. I really enjoyed listening to it. But oddly enough, Bobby Valentine's name does come up. And it's so tangential where it's the end of the season. Like, they've already lost the... So the A's had this incredible, miraculous turnaround, right? And are at the end of the season, they sadly get iced in early on in the playoffs to a team that's kind of not as good as them. And they said that Billy Beane, who's the guy that kind of constructed all of this, made this happen, was like, so not bored, I don't know what the right word is. He was looking for something to do in the offseason that could improve the team, and he realized that he wasn't really able to trade any of his assets except for the coach. So he literally, the Mets let go of Bobby Valentine and hire the man who is then the coach of the A's. And of course, Billy Bean is able to upcharge them and say, like, he just took a team with one of the lowest payrolls in baseball and won over 100 games with them. Like, you know, basically saying, I'm not the genius. This coach is the genius.
Sure.
So he ends up unloading him to the Mets for, like, a bunch of picks and money and just, like, totally fleeces him. Okay. I mean, and they get a good coach, too. But that's when – and they also say that Bobby Valentine was totally on his way out the door. They were really pissed at him at that point.
Yeah, that seems to be, like, every time Bobby Valentine – like, when he's with a team, by the time he's done with his tenure of the team, everyone just fucking hates him. Like, he managed for the Red Sox for one season. It was a disastrous 2012 season and then got canned, which rightfully so. That was a terrible, terrible year. And I don't think he's managed in baseball again. Like, Bobby Valentine, like, I have opinions about the guy. Like, I don't like... A lot of the information I got about this story was, like, firsthand. Like, he told us, like, the story during some sort of, like a meeting or dinner or something that he attended. And, like, he was, like, a speaker at it. And this guy, like, I don't like that he kind of threw Robin Ventura under the bus. Like, no, this is Robin Ventura's idea to put on the hat and the sunglasses and get back out there. Bobby Valentine, like, he's either, like, the slimiest fucking worm on the planet or the biggest fucking dork.
Yeah. I mean, again, this is so innocuous. This is so harmless.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, getting charged $5,000 is just enough to make him have to write his name on a check. That's probably more of an insult than losing $5,000 if you're him.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder how much he was making to manage the Mets in 1999, but it probably wasn't even a drop in the bucket for him.
Yeah.
So,
June by the 11th. Way, I like that the biggest thing that we're gonna have talked about is an event that didn't even happen in a game of that wasn't even an actual part of a game of baseball in the regular season at the start of the season between the fucking Mets and Blue Jays.
Right.
And that's gonna be like 20 minutes of this podcast.
Like, there are other, of course, other things that happen. Like, I'm sure there are a ton of great games that were played in June of 1999, but like. One of the funnest things about baseball is just the stuff that happens in between the plays. Like, baseball is weird, and it's dirty, and it's gross, and it's got dirty and gross people in it, like Bobby Valentine, but that's what makes it fun.
I'm sure it's a little bit of Stockholm Syndrome, too, where imagine you're like a bullpen pitcher,
God.
And you gotta just be out there for like 5 hours a day every day.
Uh-huh.
It's just like, oh, fuck this.
What are we doing?
Because like, I've seen some weird stuff happen. Yeah, where they're just, like, so bored, and they just have no fucking clue what they're doing with themselves.
Mm-hmm. So...
But that paycheck's nice.
True.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, I'll do that. I'll stay out there 5 hours a day every day. That's fine.
What was it? I think 2 years ago, the Yankees... the Yankees outfield had a greater GDP than the Dominican Republic.
Oh, my God.
Some weird stat like that. I forget what it was, but...
That's horrifying.
Yeah, they you could fund a small island nation with the money spent on these baseball players.
Mm-hmm. All right, so on June 11th, we got a movie, Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, which is the second movie in the Austin Powers series. It was released in theaters in the U.S., went on to make $312 million. Wasn't everyone tired of Austin Powers by the time the second one came out?
Wes, were you about to say something? Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, I mean, no, I nothing came out of my mouth. No, I saw this one before the first one, so no,
oh, yeah?
I wasn't sick of it. I was a kid. I was like, ooh, funny. Like,
I think the second one's funnier than the first one. And yeah. Neither is that particularly great, but the second one I think is certainly better than the first. It is at least funnier.
I mean, it was probably right around, well, it was probably like in the fall or the winter of 99 that I engaged with the Austin Powers franchise, because the first time I ever had any sort of interest or anything in watching it was me and my buddy John rented the first...
Wait, but you're John, though.
Yeah, I had a friend whose name was also John.
That must have been confusing.
Yeah. We rented these movies over a weekend, and we were like, we've never seen these. These are probably really dumb. And we watched them, and, you know, our 14, 15-year-old selves were just... We found Austin Powers himself totally obnoxious, but we were enamored with Dr. Evil. Fucking loved yep. that guy. And yep. none of this probably holds up well at all, but... I don't know, I always just found Austin Powers himself, like, that character just obnoxious.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
It is ripe for parody, the whole... Yeah. kind of spy film kind of thing that they're doing. I mean, I guess you technically have something like, what, Hot Shots? And Hot Shots is more of a parody of, like, Top Gun and American action movies.
Sure.
Than it is more of a, like, a spy thriller kind of thing.
Yeah, like a James Bond type of parody.
Yeah. But I remember it being... It's crass, and it's got some kind of lowbrow humor in it. But, yeah, Mike Myers is fantastic. He's great in it, and he's got all of the characters he portrays. Like, I haven't seen this movie in, like, a decade, so I can't really say for sure. But I do remember going back, and I watched them both, and I remember the first one seeing it after I had seen the second, and coming back thinking, like, man, the first one really didn't have as much of the stuff that the second one did. Mm. You know? But that's just my opinion. I think I did see the third one, too, which really was just not that good.
That was terrible. That was absolutely terrible.
Well, yeah. You know, with these movies, every time they're trying to, like, they have to one-up themselves. So, you know, the second one... You know, you have all the stuff from the first one, plus then by the time you get to the third and beyond, I don't even know if they made a fourth one, but...
I don't think they did, no.
You know, you have some, yeah. Like, truly ridiculous things happening.
So, actually, a better comedy came out literally a week later.
Go on.
I don't know if you have this one on your list, but I see that in June 17th, 1999, Big Daddy came out.
Oh, is that true?
That was a great movie.
I don't have that one.
Yeah, that, and I mean, we don't have to go through all of the features, but that was an interesting day for the theaters. It was Big Daddy, Run Lola Run, the German film. That's pretty cool.
Oh, nice.
And Disney released Tarzan. So I don't know what your take is on that, but that happened.
I intentionally left it off. I didn't notice that one.
Yeah. Because when you think of you know, the music that captures the rainforest, of course, it's Phil Collins.
Yeah, of course.
and that's fucking white boy Phil Collins.
We might as well mention it now, but we're going to be talking about the South Park movie in a little bit. But the South Park movie, Bigger, Longer, Uncut, was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Song. And they lost
Oh, go ahead. What was that?
They didn't win the Academy Award. Phil Collins won for his Tarzan song. And they were so fucking salty about it. Like, the next season of South Park, they kept making Phil Collins jokes.
Well, I want to say it's Mark Shaman is the guy that did the soundtrack. I'm going to look it up right now. Or that did the... it's Mark Shaman. He did the orchestral score behind it. If you ever get the chance to... I know that it's Matt Stone and Trey Parker, and the songs are silly. But it is one of the most lush orchestral scores you'll ever hear.
Yeah,
the soundtrack,
it's good.
Really is beautiful. Okay.
The soundtrack to the South Park movie, I don't know if he did the Team America soundtrack, but like, those are legitimately good soundtracks and scores.
This is a guy who's, by the way, okay, so in 1995 he was nominated for the American President for Academy Award for Best Score. 1996, First Wives Club. 1998, Patch Adams nominated. South Park, Bigger, Longer, Uncut. The Story of Us, in which he worked with Eric Clapton. So this guy crushed, like, literally the 90s. He was owning this. Oh, in 1993, Sleepless in Seattle, Best Original Song. Like,
this is hilarious to hear all these movies, and then right in the middle is South Park, right in the middle of all of
these. Well, no, like, be fair. Patch Adams was in there, too, and that's a steaming pile of shit.
No, just the type of movies and everything. Like, they're all, like, dramatic and, like, feel-good movies, and then, like, here's South Park right in the middle of all this stuff.
Well, to their credit, like, Matt Stone and Trey Parker, this isn't their first musical. They've made musicals before. They can at least show Matt Shaman, like, hey, we... Like, if you've ever... Cannibal the Musical? Or Hannibal the Musical?
That was fun. Oh, yeah.
Cannibal the Musical, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The music's genuinely good. It's not like... They're intentionally making fun of musicals. They clearly love musicals, which is kind of an odd thing to think that these two guys would be obsessed with them. But they appreciate the ornate nature of them, and they like the pomp and circumstance. So they were probably thrilled that they could snag a guy like Mark Shaman. And it shows. Yeah, that record is just so good. I love it.
So, comics real quick.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, couple minutes for comics. And
comics existed. Moving on.
Sure did. Good. We talked last month. We talked about the two X-Men flagship series, Uncanny X-Men and just X-Men. So I gave a little bit of a preview of what was going to be happening in those, so I won't give, like, recaps of the individual issues, but just kind of, like, generally what was happening in two different X-Men series. at the time. X-Force was still going. I think they were like in the early 90s for those issues. There's a storyline with this character called the Armageddon Man, and he was a character who was put in suspended animation by the U.S. government. He controlled weather and natural disasters. But this was his first appearance. He had never been mentioned before in any sort of X-Men storyline. If you remember the character Bedlam, who was a short-lived character in the Deadpool 2 movie played by Terry Crews, he was a member of X-Force for a little while. And his big journey that he was on, he was looking for his missing brother. He finds his missing brother, who's trying to revive this Armageddon Man who has these cataclysmic powers for the purpose, of course, of holding the world hostage and getting a lot of money or something. But
I remember there was an X-Men that was I'm trying to think of how to describe her power. It was she could create storms, you know, and lightning and rain and wind and stuff. Big storms would happen.
Yeah, yeah, that one's slipping
Weather
my
Girl.
Mind too.
Aurora, that's her name. It's Aurora, right? She worked for the UN or something. She has diplomatic immunity.
Stop it.
Come on. So, tell me more about this Armageddon.
There's really nothing interesting about Armageddon Man. The storyline, he's trying to get revived, they stop him, and then he goes away. You never hear from him again. Some of the interesting things that happen in this particular storyline, there's a character called Taro, who kind of predicts the future using tarot cards. She makes an appearance. She was presumed dead when her group of anti-heroes, the Hellions, were killed by Fitzroy. She was sort of mentored by Emma Frost, and kind of went to an Xavier school that Emma Frost was running, kind of this the arrival of the young X-Men teams. You thought she'd been killed off, but it turns out that she made it out of there alive. Also, a character, Feral, makes an appearance after quite some time being gone. She was actually part of the original roster of X-Force, but left/got kicked off the team because she was crazy and homicidal. In the events of the Armageddon Man storyline, she actually slices open Siren's throat. You might remember Siren as Banshee's daughter. And this is when Siren gets benched for the remainder of the X-Force series because she gets depowered because, her throat gets sliced open. So, she loses her voice. And she'll eventually make another appearance in New X-Men with her powers back in 2002. But, yeah, from 1999 to 2002, she's gone. And then Generation X is also an ongoing series in 99. They are in the early 50s in their issue number, and they last about 75 issues. They only go on for another two and a half years after this. But there's a lot of teen drama at this point of the series, and it was kind of the point of Generation X in general. The series was made to bring in younger readers by sort of playing on the teenage angst sort of character arcs for all their mutants in the series. There's some relationship drama between two characters, Chamber and Husk. Emma Frost is running this particular training school for Xavier because Xavier's not training the younger mutants anymore. But her sister shows up as a sort of benefactor for the school because Emma Frost herself has fallen on hard financial times, but was as part of the sort of a reconciliation between those two characters, they started having to admit non-mutant students to the school. So the original mutant students at the school have to sort of pass for human, which is easier for the female characters in the book. But, Chamber has half of a face and the character's skin is gray. So a little bit harder for them to be walking around with all the rest of the humans. There are two characters, Artie and Leech. They're younger characters. They're still hanging around in the story, but they don't do much except cause general mischief and dress up like pig Spider-Man. But yeah,
you know, it's wild. I looked it up because you're talking about basically trying to craft the Marvel X-Men related property around kind of teenage angst and things like that. So the first thing that of course came to my mind was X-Men Evolution.
Uh-huh.
And its release date was November 2000.
Yeah.
Yep. So we're just about a year away from that coming out. I don't know if you guys remember watching that series, but I enjoyed it quite a bit as a kid.
I did like that one. Yeah, that was a fun show. And they actually spun off a comic book series based on the popularity of the show. So it did well for them.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll get to that in about a year and 3 months.
Yep. So I got nothing on the list until June 28th. So we got a bit of a jump here. You guys got anything else you want to address before we move on to another game?
June 28th. No, we can move on.
Okay. So June 28th, Pokemon Pinball is released on the Game Boy. So we got another Game Boy game here, which is cool. Developed by Jupiter and HAL Laboratories. HAL Laboratories you might recognize from a lot of different places, like Super Smash Bros., Kirby, a lot of different things that they work with Nintendo quite closely. Jupiter also works with Nintendo quite closely still to this day. They do a lot of those Picross puzzle games now. Pokemon Pinball, published by Nintendo North America. There's two different pinball tables in this game. You got a red and a blue. And it's just like pinball, you run up a score, but there's also like some Pokedex filling stuff that you do in this game. So by hitting different bumpers and stuff, you activate a catch mode. You have to hit six. Once you activate catch mode, you have to hit six specific bumpers on the screen, and that will make the Pokemon appear. And then you have to hit the Pokemon with the ball four times in order to catch it. And then, in addition to catch mode, there's also an evolution mode. And when you activate evolution mode, there are these targets that will appear on the playfield, and you have to hit some of them, usually not all of them. And then a different spot for the ball will open up, and you have to sink the ball into that spot, and then the Pokemon that you've selected will evolve. And of course, I'm not sure when you make the selection, but you select a Pokemon and only Pokemon that can evolve can be selected, of course. So you have the original roster of 151 in here that you can collect, and of course the game will save your project at progress as you fill up the Pokedex. So yeah, a pretty well received game at the time. Kind of cool.
Yeah, honestly, for whatever reason, not that pinballs is like the coolest thing ever, but I don't think I've ever truly enjoyed pinball in any capacity.
I know what you mean.
I've just never appreciated. I've never understood the appeal.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat. I agree. So June 30th.
I know there's like a whole pinball culture and everything, but it's just whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I don't mean to diminish pinball. If it's someone's favorite hobby, it's just never been for me.
Yeah.
So June 30th also came out, Jonathan.
Oh, well, South Park, Bigger, Longer, Uncut. We touched on it already. It was released in the U.S. theaters. It made $83 million worldwide. And, of course, like we mentioned, nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Song. I love this movie. To this day. I haven't watched it in several years. But
me too.
Yeah, this is... It's interesting because they made a movie that the plot revolved around. What would it be... How would people react if we made a South Park movie? And of course, they use their proxies, Terrence and Philip, to sort of move the plot forward on that point.
Oh yeah, well, and it's also you get Satan mm-hmm. in there, of course, as a classic character yep. from the thing, and then they also bring in Saddam Hussein, who was alive at the time, which is just hilarious.
Yeah.
And this is also pretty early. If you think about South Park is still going, 21 years later, South Park is still an yep. active show. So that's wild to think that this movie kind of occurred so early in the life cycle of this series. And of course, this is a group no one should doubt the genius of these two guys. They're, they're Tony Award winners. They're clearly very, very talented. Oh, I love that they both dressed up. One of them wore the Jennifer Lopez green mm-hmm. V-dress to the Oscars that year. And apparently both of them were on acid yep. at the time. They both took hits of acid before going into the thing.
Oh, my God.
So they're both, fucked up.
Tripping balls.
God, they are great. Yeah, it's just...
It shows that,
Man, yeah, it's
It
so
shows
funny.
That their irreverence comes from a genuine place. Because this is, it's the Academy Awards. It's, supposed to be, the premiere, where cinema is celebrated, and they're in drag doing acid.
Yep.
On the same day, Wild Wild West, speaking of train wrecks, was released in U.S. theaters, made $220 million yeah. over its lifetime, and this one was nominated for some awards as well, 8 Golden Raspberry Awards.
Damn, that's bad. I mean, here's the thing, though. There is kind of a grandeur to this film. It is so bad that it's kind of... you have to sort of just take it all in and appreciate the grandeur of how shitty a film it is.
I guess. It is really, really bad.
It's got some wild action set pieces. Who's in it? The Spanish
Selma
woman
Hayek.
In it. You get to see her butt. You get to see Selma Hayek's butt. That's really nice. It's based... It's the other thing is, it's based on an original series. that I never watched.
Neither did I.
But I'm pretty sure Jim West was not a black man. so I think that was supposed to be kind of controversial. I don't know. I mean,
but it's Will Smith, guys. He can't do it.
That seems so innocuous now. They recast a white guy as a black guy for a movie adaptation. I don't know why anyone would give a fuck now. That seems quaint that people would care about it.
I mean, it would be weird in that it's anachronistic, I guess you could say. I mean, like, you wouldn't have had a black man be sheriff at that time for a town full of white people. I mean, again, kind of like Blazing Saddles. Blazing Saddles, which, by the way, is an amazing comedy.
until it all falls apart in the last 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, the giant spider bot didn't do it for you?
No. That too, but we've moved on to Blazing Saddles now, which is a better movie.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Blazing Saddles is an odd movie that it sort of didn't. Do you know how it ends, Wes?
Yeah. Don't they, like, the police show up and they get arrested or something? No.
They break the fourth wall, literally. Like they kind of burst through the studio.
Yeah, that's right.
You get the sense that they didn't know how to end it. So, yeah, of course.
I thought that was amazing way to end it, though.
Like, there was a big hit single that came out of Wild Wild West, right?
Sure.
There's that thing where they left Stevie Wonder on stage. I don't know if you remember that. Like, they are using a Stevie Wonder sample for the song Wild Wild West, which was approved by him. And then at the award show, I don't know which award show it was, probably like MTV Movie Awards or something, they did like a live thing on stage where it was like Will Smith and his backing band was there, and then they had... they kind of brought him in where they're like, it's Stevie Wonder, everybody, and he's playing piano along to the song, right? But then, like, when it's over, nobody goes and gets him off the stage. Yeah, so somebody has to, like, awkwardly come out there and, like, kind of get him.
That's horrifying. Oh. How long did they leave him stranded up there?
2 hours.
thankfully not long. No, it was pretty apparent when everyone was leaving the stage and Stevie was just sort of chilling there in front of the piano that it's like, okay, nobody...
God, like, the show is over, the janitor was sweeping up, he's still there.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I don't know, this is like an eventful movie, though. I feel like there's a, for it being kind of a shit film, it's still kind of... It's bad, but enjoyable. Really kind of like... Is this any better or worse than the Austin Powers movies, honestly?
Like, no, probably not. But like, but you know. Do you remember like the sort of Kevin Smith gossip around this movie?
Yes, I think it was because of Barry Sonnenfeld, wasn't it? The director of it.
That sounds about right, like the producer or something. But yeah, there was.
Maybe it was a producer. Yeah.
There was that like point where Kevin Smith was sort of signed on to write a Superman movie, and one of the things that the producer had specific demands, like Superman doesn't wear his suit, he doesn't fly. And at some point in the movie, he has to fight a giant spider. And of course, like, he couldn't make any of this work. But then, like, a year later, this Wild Wild West movie comes out. And what happens in the end? That same producer is on, and Will Smith ends up fighting a giant metal spider.
Yep.
So he figured it out.
Yeah, he made it work somehow.
Yeah.
It's
like when you hear like they hate when the executive give them notes. Mm-hmm. They're like trying to make a movie or something, and they get the executive's notes, and it's just like they just want to burn them. This is the worst advice anyone's ever had about anything.
Yeah. One of these,
thank you for funding this. Don't be involved at all in its production.
And now that I think about it, there's at least one episode of South Park where they reference Wild Wild West.
Yeah, Cartman dresses up as Will Smith's character, as I recall.
Yeah.
And he's, like, singing Wild Wild West or something. I haven't seen this in a long time, but...
But yeah, it's funny, because, like, it's another movie that came out. Like, it came out the same day, and there were probably, like, at least a couple million dollars of tickets sold to Wild Wild West that, you know, were just underage kids who bought a ticket for that and then just went to see South Park instead.
You know that happened. That happened with me. I don't remember what the ticket I bought initially was, but it was to go see the Beavis and Butthead movie.
Hmm.
Which, by the way, is actually a pretty solid movie. Okay. It's worth seeing.
So, I mean, I think that it's easy to forget that Beavis and Butthead was like Mike Judge, who was behind that show. And he did like King of the Hill and Office Space and all like this other good stuff.
A movie that becomes more relevant every day is Idiocracy.
True. God. Yeah. That movie is horrifyingly tame now.
It's got electrolytes, which is what plants
It's got what
crave.
Plants want, yeah.
Yeah, electrolytes.
Upgrade gonna get his money.
Yeah, that movie is so prophetic. Oh. It makes you wonder,
to
like
Costco. I love you.
What if they were like, I sure could go for some Starbucks, and he's like, we don't have time for a hand job. It's like, there you go again with that fag talk. Your shit's fucking. You talk like a fag.
All right, Wes. June 30th, we got a video game release on the N64, ooh. Pokemon Snap.
Oh, I love this game so
you
much.
You are a resident.
I do.
You're a resident Pokemon Snap expert.
I love this game, and at that age, I was really into photography, and you know, I did photography for years out of high school and everything. I took photography in high school. I was the photo editor my senior year. I did freelance work out of high school, and I think it was all because of this video game.
Oh, yeah?
It was just a lot of fun taking pictures and stuff. I was like, this is fantastic. I could do more of this. And then, bam, went with it. But this game, oh, I love this game. So it's an on-rail Pokemon game. You play as, I forget the dude's name, but he's from the TV show.
Jim West.
Sure, that guy. And you're just going around to this little cart taking pictures of Pokemon as you're going around. And they're just running around, just doing their own thing. You're just taking shots. It's a little fun. There's a lot of little things you can do as the game progresses. As you get through the levels, you unlock other kind of things. Like the first thing you unlock is you can throw apples. And so with the apples,
yeah,
you can like
right.
lure Pokemon to certain spots, or just hit Pokemon and it'll cause them to like stir and do things. You can throw apples in the water and fish Pokemon or jump out. Water and everything like that, and so it broadens up some more options. The first thing you can do, it was just the dumbest thing, but it was on the beach level, and you could throw apples to lure Pikachu over to a surfboard, and he'll hop on the surfboard, and boom, now you got a picture of Pikachu surfing in the sand.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. Is that why the Alolan form has a surfboard? Or will he technically surf on his tail?
It was just one of the things with it. I don't know why they're obsessed with Pikachu surfing. I just don't get it.
Oh, there was that... wasn't there a special Pikachu you could download in, like, Oris where, like, it knew the move Surf?
Yeah, it was something like that. I forget which... It was something like that. I can't remember.
Anyway, yeah, maybe it all does stem from Pokemon Snap in that surfboard picture.
It's just a thing. Yeah, they just went with it. It was crazy.
But that was like one of the most interesting things about the game to me is that, like, you know, you do have like the on rails photography, but like interacting with like Pokemon in the environments in certain ways would make different ones appear and give you like different framing for like different shots you could take. Yeah, it's a cool idea for a game.
Mm-hmm.
And like the overall objective is like you have to like fill up your Pokedex by taking pictures of them or something like that.
Yeah, to fill up the Pokedex is by taking pictures, but also you get points on the type of picture, and I don't know how the game could tell, but like how much of the frame the Pokemon was in it, and based on poses and everything, you can unlock hidden things with different Pokemon to get more points with that particular shot. And you had to do some creative stuff. Like one level, you had to use the apples to get Charmeleon around this little crater, and then you had to knock Charmeleon into like this little thing of lava.
Oh god.
And then he evolves into Charizard, and that's how you get the Charizard pictures.
Hmm.
So like you have to throw stuff at Pokemon to get things done.
Yep. Did you ever like print out your stickers at Blockbuster?
I did, and some of those pictures that I printed out are on my Pokemon card.
Shut
binders.
The fuck up.
I kid you not, they are on my binders. Where, oh, they're right here.
Wow.
And they're sitting on
oh,
the little
Wes.
Table
you're
right here.
You're fucking a rock star. That's cool.
We are.
This is the sad part about not doing a video podcast, yeah, is because everyone deserves to see this.
They totally do. They totally do. Where is it?
I know, right?
Yep. This is going to be tough for you guys to see.
That's okay.
But they're really they're really tiny and faded.
All like the smallest
little
squares.
Guys. The smaller squares are ones.
That's
those
amazing.
Are actual pictures I've taken, printed out. Yep.
How cool is that?
Oh, nice. It is.
Is that a Quicksilver sticker too? Oh my God, Wes! I never knew you were that cool.
Like I have Pikachu with an apple and a couple of these things. I don't know. Oh, this one here was another hidden one. It's Pikachu flying through the air, tied to a bunch of balloons.
That's amazing. That is tremendous. So
good.
It was the only there's the only place you could do it. You could only pick out, you'd only put out these stickers at Blockbuster. And, you know, for the kids listening, Blockbuster was a chain of brick and mortar video rental stores. And for the kids listening, video rentals were like streaming movies, but like they're on a disc and you had to eventually bring them back.
Yeah, actually, it's kind of funny. That's the only memory I have of even playing this game, is I remember for a few months there, like every time we would go to Blockbuster, they would have the console set up and you could play the first round. And I remember it was, yeah, you were like on a minecart essentially going through this stuff. And I think you could take pictures of like, you know, Pikachu, and I think there was like a Gyarados and a waterfall or something. And I mean, I don't know. The game seems cool. I just never bothered to play it.
It's oddly intuitive. Like, there's just so many little things you would not have thought of. You literally just have to mess around to find things, and it's not like, oh, that's how you do it. Like, you literally had to mess around. Some levels I remember to this day, going back, and I'm like, how on earth did you get this stupid Zapdos egg to hatch? Like, just nonsense.
Also, isn't it crazy that if you think about it, probably, like, one of the most popular games of the past few years is Pokemon Go. Which is, again, essentially a game in which we use our phones as cameras to snap Pokemon. Like, in a weird way, like, they kind of knew we were going to want to take pictures of augmented reality environments in which Pokemon are there. I mean, granted, most people don't play it that way. Most people aren't using their actual camera to do stuff in it, but, you know. Well, that was, like, a weird cultural moment a few years ago when that game really was at its peak. I feel like the game's kind of like, I don't know if anyone really talks about it anymore. I think there's still a handful of loyal Pokemon Go players, but for the most part, I think the craze kind of died down.
Yeah, you know, you look at like the stats that Niantic and the Pokemon come to release every so often. You know, they still, you know, rake in a ton of cash with it, and they still have a pretty big user base, and they're always adding new things to it. But you know, the sort of hype train has slowed down. Like they have a pretty good base, and it's going strong, but you know, it's not part of the general conversation anymore. I mean, we don't even like talk about it first thing we do the Pokemon shows anymore.
Yeah, true. Probably also because I don't really play it that much anymore. Like, I think I was the one that was really playing it the most of all of us.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still, I don't know if it's been done yet, but I'm still waiting for the cross pollination with that in Pokemon Home, because Pokemon Go is actually a really easy way to get just a ton of random shinies, so it would be nice to port over all of the shinies I have.
Yeah. So Pokemon Snap, like, there was a, I think just before Pokemon Go came out, maybe Pokemon Go has done something to kind of assuage people's desires for a sequel, but there was a point where, like, there was a pretty big demand for a sequel on the Wii U, and the Wii U as a piece of hardware would have been really cool, like, for the sort of, like, you have your main screen on the TV, and then you move your gamepad around as your camera, and like can kind of like use the whole space of the room to like move forward and snap pictures on an on rails like photography game. It would have been a neat thing for them to try, but you know, for whatever reason.
Did you do the part in Sun and Moon yet? You're doing a run through of Sun and Moon, right? Or had you done one?
No.
Yours is Oris. You're doing Oris. Yeah. I think it's Sun and Moon. There's a part where you're going through this kind of like really shitty part of town, and you have to go into this underground warehouse thing. And then part of the underground warehouse thing actually literally requires you to use your DS in the camera mode thing. And you got to find the Pokemon in the room.
Huh. I don't remember that.
Yeah, it was like poison types and gang. I know. I think it was Ghastlies. It was Ghastlies and Haunters
were
hidden
around. Oh, sure. Yeah, that's where you run into the Mimikyus for the first time.
Yeah, oh no, maybe that is Sun and Moon. Yeah, Sun and Moon.
Yeah, that's Sun and Moon. That's in that weird convenience store.
But anyway, Pokemon Snap, developed by HAL, published by Nintendo, of course, sold about 1.5 million copies over the life of the system. It did get a virtual console release on Wii, which you cannot get anymore.
Luckily, I do have that on my Wii.
Oh, do you? Look at that.
I do.
The fuck, Wes? Man, just showing up. He's got it.
I love this game.
You can get a used copy for the N64 for about $20. That's not too bad.
I'm pretty sure I also still have my N64 version somewhere.
Nice.
Yeah.
So
that's like two Pokemon games get released with Nintendo consoles within 2 days of each other. That's interesting.
Oh yeah, we're like fully in the Pokemon craze. We don't yet have a release for Gen 2 for Gold Silver, and I think Pokemon Yellow is just around the corner for us in our retrospectives here. But yeah,
I looked ahead for the North American release date of Stadium, Mm-hmm. And Stadium comes out next year.
Okay.
Early next year.
Yeah, and that'll like take advantage of like the transfer pack and all that fun stuff to get your copies off, get your pokes off the Gen 1 games and onto your N64. It's interesting that like the N64 is also trying to leverage the popularity of Pokemon, even though like Pokemon doesn't come off of handhelds. Like the mainline games don't go from handheld to home console until the Switch 21 years later. But they're still trying to leverage the popularity of that. And, you know, for the most part, it pays off for them pretty well in North America. But in Japan, where Pokemon is also super popular, you know, the N64 never really moved units. So not even Pokemon could get people to jump on board over there. Hmm. So, last game for the night. Quake 2 comes out on N64. This game was ported to the N64 by a company named Raster Productions. A PC version originally came out in December of 97, and from most sources that I've been able to go to, it's considered mostly identical to the PC version, so there's that. It does not have the network play, of course, but instead has split-screen multiplayer. But on that, that's all I got on Quake 2. Ryan, take us away.
You want me to leave this one? Okay, so I'm pretty sure we've talked about Quake before. Quake is like an all-time great game and one that really should change people's perspective on what games are and should be, because it's so such a weirdly like deep and atmospheric kind of game. It's so far ahead. It's a really crisp game that handles well with a mouse and keyboard. You literally hit the tab, or not the tab key, the tilde key on your keyboard, and you have the console there to make adjustments to the game itself. You know, there's no story. It's really just you going through these Lovecraft-inspired, horrific space marine levels. It's really hard to describe. It's got its own art style that really is so fitting. It's an incredible experience. It's really shocking that the game came out when it did and still feels so real. The first-person shooters of today age terribly, I feel like. You know, you go back in time and look at one from 5 to 10 years ago, and it's just like, it looks like garbage. But then Quake just kind of has this charm. It's like it's going to live forever and always be its thing. And it's just fucking fantastic. I love this game so much. I think anybody that has a computer needs to spend a few minutes just immersing themselves in the world of Quake. So, with that as the expectation, right, Quake 2 comes out years later. This is after a really key figure in Quake is now left, a guy named John Romero. Your other guy is John Carmack. Carmack is sort of like the brains of the operation, and Romero can be thought of as like the heart and soul of the operation. Romero did a lot of the great levels in the game of the original Quake. He it was his idea to incorporate all the Lovecraftian stuff. He's the one that put such an emphasis on mood. And the game sort of plays through levels. I mean, it's essentially like 30-something actual levels if you want to break it down. And, like, again, there's no real story. The best you get is, like, the names of the levels are super evocative. Like, I love these. Like, just, I'll name a few. Like, the Vault of Zen, the Tomb of Terror, the Haunted Hills, you know, like, the Tower of Despair, the Elder God Shrine, the Azure Agony, Gloom Keep, the Grizzly Grotto, Necropolis. Every one of these level names is like kind of evokes a sense of dread and horror, and that's really the only language you get about anything. Otherwise, it's essentially just a maybe find a few keys, kill as many things as you can, find the secrets that are in there, and then just sort of blast your way through the game and just kind of crush. And it's not like Doom. Like, of course, Doom is like the original first-person shooter in a lot of people's perspectives, a lot of people's eyes. Quake has a lot fewer enemies. The combat's a lot more impactful, and like the fights have more meaning. There's kind of a sense of resource management you have to deal with that you probably didn't experience with just a sort of blasting away monsters in Doom. And again, that soundtrack done by Nine Inch Nails is just absolutely wonderful. It's very dark and ambient. It ditches the whole guitar, electric guitar, heavy metal aesthetic. But now we fast forward to Quake 2. And Quake 2 is still Carmack, it's still his engine, it's still his thing, but for starters, this was never even supposed to be a Quake game. It was originally had some other plan in mind for it, but I think they got to the point where they're like, well, we might as well just release it as Quake 2. It feels so much like a Quake game. There's no Romero anymore, so they've totally abandoned the entire Lovecraft vibe, which I think is a very much to the detriment of it. If there's one thing that really makes Quake feel like Quake, it's that kind of gothic, dark, magic sense to it. It feels magical. It feels like it's just as much magic as science fiction. Probably the big thing that you would bring up in Quake 2 is say that it's not so much episodic. It's not like it's 38 levels or whatever. It's more like 10 worlds that you're in, and you can travel freely between them. I mean, you'll get to points where you're cut off from going back any further, sure. But for the most part, to accomplish things, if you need to get your red card or your blue card or whatever, you have to go and do that. You have to actually go to another different part, not in your like your map or anything, get it, and then go back. So there's definitely a lot of navigation that you have to do, and it creates a lot more bigger, open, complex levels for you to kind of navigate and explore. And you now also have not only your heads-up display, but you actually have, like, a menu system. Not a menu, but, like, you can bring up a screen which basically says, here's your primary objective, here's your secondary objective, here's everything you have in your inventory, including things like aqua suits, biohazard suits, triggerable Quake icons, on top of your guns and ammunition. Now I'm just getting into the nuts and bolts stuff of Quake 2. The other big thing is that you don't really have that cool score anymore. It's gone back to Doom. If anything, this feels more like, I know there was a Doom 2, but this feels more like Doom 2 than it feels like Quake 2. And there's an attempt to have a story. You actually hear a little bit of like voice work from actors. If you think about it, in the original Quake, no one ever says anything. You really don't hear any actual spoken dialogue, aside from the moans and grunts of your guy. But in Quake 2, you actually hear a lot of static and a lot of radio chatter from other people that are supposed to be like alive in the world, that are probably getting their shit kicked in by all these crazy monsters. There are no bosses? Really, if anything, they set up the normal monsters as bosses. Usually the first time you encounter one of a new boss, or a new enemy in the game, it's staged in such a way that it's like a threatening environment where it feels almost like a boss. But then, from that point on, you may regularly encounter multiples of them in a given stage. And it's just, again, supposed to kind of give you that ramp up, that kind of scale up in what you do.
Yeah.
The shotgun's back. They do this really nice thing where, because if you remember in the original Quake, you had the nail gun and then the super nail gun. They've replaced that with a straight up, like, a little machine gun, which is cool. But then you also have, like, a chain gun, which just eats through ammo like crazy. So they did a good job of not just having it be like, you know, you have your regular shotgun and your super shotgun and then your nail gun and then your super nail gun or whatever. They make it so that both have their place. And depending upon your play style, you will toggle between them. You don't always want to be running your chain gun because you'll piss away ammo to take out a boss. Whereas sometimes the thing may be a serious threat that needs to die immediately, so you want to immediately pump 50 rounds into it. It's an old school shooter. It's very sparse. You know, if you explore the world, it's all science fiction, all like kind of grisly and violent and all that, but nothing mysterious about it, I guess, if that makes sense. And all of the bad guys are sort of these weird like hybrid alien human combo monster thingies, like it's honestly not that great.
Not kind of like great. Goombas from the Super Mario movie.
Oh.
Yeah, no, true. Again, I'm such a big fan of Quake. And also, Quake 3 Arena is fantastic. Quake 3 Arena is amazing. Like, I remember playing that for the first time, and I was like, this is real. This is the closest to realism video games could ever be. Like, it looked and felt so good to play that game. And Quake 2, by comparison, is a little chunky. It's a little, I don't know. Doesn't quite do it for me, honestly. But it's still a tight game. It's a really well-refined game. It plays great. It's still got that same kind of direct, tangible input you want from a first-person shooter. The sound is great still. Like, when you ricochet those grenades, you can just hearing that sound just makes me happy. like where it kind of goes like bling bling bling, and just kind of, you know, like a Plinko chip dropping down a board or something. It just sounds so good, you know. Yeah, it, a lot of positive feedback in this game. You'll feel it as you play it. But really, it's certainly the lesser of the series. Oh, and yeah, and I haven't played the Quake. I haven't played Quake 2 on N64, so I can't really comment on the localization of it. I watched some gameplay of it. Graphics look pretty good. I mean, granted, this is an older game in the first place. This game's been out for a couple of years. By the time, or about, not that long, about a year and a half.
Year and a half. Yeah.
By the time it makes its way to the N64. But yeah, yeah. I mean, it looks good. Oh, I did see. I was watching a playthrough of somebody playing it on the N64, and they showed that a really nice feature is that because these games were so ubiquitous with the console, they changed two control schemes. You could default your control scheme to either be whatever it was supposed to be for the Quake 2, whatever the developers intended. Your other ones were a Turok setup. It was set up to look like Turok, and then another one was set up to look like GoldenEye. So if you were a GoldenEye player, played a ton of that, and you're just like, oh, wait, I just want to play some Quake, slam in your Quake cartridge, it'll feel exactly right. So I thought that was a very, very nice touch on the developer's part to localize like that.
It's a good idea to have that that option in their form, especially because of how ubiquitous GoldenEye was. It's got an easy way to jump in and play some familiar. Because I thought that out of the handful of shooter games that I played in the N64 so far, I think that GoldenEye handled the controls the best. It's kind of the closest thing that they've been able to get to approximate like dual analog sticks. But yeah, it's cool that you can have GoldenEye controls, if you're looking for something familiar, and you could have Turok controls if you're a bad person.
Hey, and maybe the Turok game itself is all garbage, but maybe the control scheme was supposed to make sense.
Nope, sure doesn't.
Yeah. All right.
Downstairs at one point in your life.
Yeah. Did you price out a cartridge?
$20.
Okay, that's not so bad.
Yeah. Yeah, especially compared to like what cartridges for some other systems are going for. Like GBA cartridge prices are on the rise. DS cartridge prices are on the rise. As we talked about with like the Pokemon games the other week. Yeah, these older carts are getting pretty expensive.
Yep. And yeah, again, I'm sure this is also a game that you can get for dirt cheap. I know in my Steam library, I have the complete Quake collection. So I actually did a couple of days ago, booted it up and played it for a couple hours just to kind of get back into it, just to kind of remember the feeling of it. And yeah, it really is, especially for its time, it's a great game. But yeah, it just comes off feeling a little soulless. I don't want to be in the game. And the way that I want to be in the game of Quake, in spite of how horrific it is.
Hmm. Cool. Well, that's all I had in the notes. You guys got anything else for June of 1999 that you want to go through? Or should we pull the plug?
I think that's all I got on me.
Okay.
Yep, that's all I got.
Cool. So, One thing, we're not going to do it today, but the next time we do a retro show, we're going to have to address the ranking, because I do, I am back at work, so I do have access to the ranking again. One thing that I need to do before we jump into, though, is I need to make a list of the games that we have now talked about since we stopped doing the rankings back in February or March. So I'll send you guys the rankings, of course, and then what we've talked about. We can kind of deliberate what goes where, and then address that on the next one, and then get back into slotting things in where they should be in our objective scientific ranking of all N64 games.
Nice.
Not all N64 games, just the ones we deem worthy of conversation.
What are you talking about? This is factual.
Oh, yeah, we are using science.
This is the actual ranking.
Yeah.
This is the actual ranking.
Right, but the games we don't talk about don't exist.
No, they're not important enough.
Yeah, we did pass April Fool's already. That would have been our good day to do a Mahjong breakdown of all of the different Mahjong games that exist.
Let's do one anyway.
Yeah. Oh, wait, didn't that... there's a big sale going on Switch right now. And I noticed that one of them is that ridiculous, 60 games or something all in one big pack, but it was basically, unlicensed games, like Solitaire and,
Are you talking about
chess
Clubhouse
and
games?
Checkers or... Yeah, yeah.
No, cool.
Yeah, that's a new release.
Yeah, but I think one of them, they have a bunch of different kinds of Mahjong games in there. So if you wanted to get your Mahjong action on Switch, that can happen.
We talked about that one last week, and I think when I was listening to the show during editing, I came off as like needlessly negative. Like, it seems fine, not something that I would purchase, but I don't mean to like say it doesn't have any particular value. There's a ton of stuff in there that, you know, if you're into those sort of like a casual or like card or club games, like, it seems okay.
I mean, grandma needs to play the Switch too.
And it does have like a version of bowling that looks a lot like Wii Bowling, so you know, there's something for grandma in there too.
I think you were right to pick on the game. I think that yeah, the real bosses out there, the real motherfuckers, they've got their, you know, they got their Pokemon Snap going.
That's right.
All right. So next up, we got a choice. We could do a mini show, or we could kind of hold off until the Pokemon expansion comes out, because that's out in 6 days, the time of recording here. I'm kind of leaning toward like doing a mini show and then doing a Pokemon show after that, so we get some time with the expansion before we talk about it. What do you guys think?
Yeah, it sounds pretty good.
I'd like a little bit of time to play it before we have to talk about it.
Yeah, so we're not like recording like, I played for 2 hours this afternoon, these are my definitive thoughts.
Well, it's actually nice. I didn't even realize it, but I requested off Monday and Tuesday of that week.
Nice.
So I'll have that whole weekend and then 2 days to kind of poke around in the game.
There you go.
Yep.
So, next up, we'll do a mini show, then we'll do a Pokemon show, and then wrap it up at the end of the month with an official show. That's it. That's the end. Till next time, cool. Everybody.
So long.
Later.